Right, and then I see the disinfectant that knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that? By injection inside or almost a cleaning. As you see, it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me.
It's Friday, the 1st of May, 2020. May Day, for those of you who celebrate it. And you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration at the University of Amsterdam. And I'm Darshan Vigneshwaran. I'm here with my co-host, Abby Steele. And today we have some, well, important news. Abby is a victim of coronavirus. Abby, take it away.
Well, it's all speculative because we live in the Netherlands, and so we don't really know. But yeah, this week I had a really strange experience where I have tinnitus, I don't know how to pronounce it even, mm-hmm. a problem with my ear that I've had for a couple of weeks. And so the general practitioner told me to come in this week, and I saw her, and after I described the situation and she sort of looked in my ears to make sure it wasn't just an earwax problem, which I'm happy to report to our listeners.
Which could happen.
That it's not. But on the other hand, I sort of wish it had been, you know. Oh, it's a shame she didn't just tell me to clean my ears more. She said, yeah, well, you know, maybe you have coronavirus. And I was like, what? That is really, really not what I was expecting. And she said, yeah, and actually it's probably pretty bad that I don't have any protective anything on right now. And I was like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, yeah, so all of it was kind of surprising. And then I said, well, I'm not going to get a test, am I? And she was like, no. And she was talking about this in the context of a colleague of hers who is a doctor who had similar symptoms to me with apparently right. just having tinnitus, I have no idea, the ear problem, and testing positive.
Right.
And so that was her basis for diagnosing me, I guess.
And did you ask her about the PPE and like what she felt about that?
I mean, I think I was just exposing in shock, so I was like, oh God. And so then, but then I was asking her questions like, well, should I assume I have it now? Should I be in quarantine? She was sort of like, mm-hmm. no, you should just be, you know, stand at a distance. And I was like, should I send my kids back to school when they open or maybe not? And she was like, yeah, as long as they don't have symptoms, you know, the whole thing was relaxed. And she was like, well, I've actually got another patient coming. So we can't talk too long because I don't want you to overlap with this other patient. I was sort of like, yeah, I see the logic there, but also no
one. Off you go with your corona.
Yeah, I mean, just no one in the office had any protective gear whatsoever. And so I was really surprised that ended up going how it did. And then, but then I was thinking later, like even people who are asymptomatic test positive for corona. So right. why don't they just, as a standard practice, have protective gear for doctors? And I just find it totally shocking. So yeah, that was my week.
Yeah, that sounds crazy.
Yeah.
But you're feeling well now. And
I mean, I still have this ear problem. I mean, so today,
yeah. Can you take the reins? You're taking me today to a place I've never been, like a continent I've never been.
Yes.
Yeah, you need to introduce our guest who is from Chile.
I'm delighted.
And I'm sure I'm not even pronouncing that correctly because my Spanish is terrible.
I think you did okay. Yeah, at least.
I think okay.
Yes. At least you didn't say chili, like the pepper, right? Chile comes off really harsh. So Chile... I don't know, Carla, you correct me, but that would be my
You both
take
are
on.
Doing it great. Yeah.
So I'm delighted to take you to South America to our guest today, Carla Alberte, who is an assistant professor of political science at La Católica in Santiago, which is the Catholic University of Chile. And she specializes in indigenous politics and also sort of illicit economies and how things work in the borders, and does really fascinating comparative work between different indigenous communities and how they interact with illegal armed actors, typically, you know, who are trafficking illicit goods. So keep an eye out for her work on that. And so we've invited her to talk to us about what's going on in Chile now. And Carla, I know that you've been, you know, you're on a different academic calendar than we are, different seasons, obviously, in the Southern Hemisphere. And you just started your semester, and then all of this started to happen. But you already have experience taking your courses online. Can you tell us a little bit about all of your all of your online teaching that you've been doing this year?
Yeah, sure. Well, first, thank you, Abby and Darshan, for having me. This is my first podcast ever, so thank you so much. So yeah, I mean, we have a pretty different schedule from the one you have and from the one I had when I was doing my PhD in the US. So this is pretty much, you know, calendar year, and the academic year is basically this sort of the same. So we start in March. That's when we began, the first week of March, usually we began our semester. And this year was a bit different. So we started the semester about 2 weeks later because, I don't know how it works in the Netherlands, but here students, high school students, have to take a test, like the SAT, I think. It's a national test. And they couldn't do it. It was, and I'll get to that in a sec, like the mobilization and all that. But there have been lots of complaints about how, you know, about that national test, how it is, the contents and its format and all of that. And so a group of students sort of boycotted the test. So the students ended up retaking the test in February, even, I think, or late January. So the results were just hurt their results in March, which is when we actually start the semester. So, you know, we started in March. Actually, the first year students started on the 12th, I think. And so it was really bad for them because we transitioned to online classes on the 16th of March.
Oh. So they had 4 days of classes.
Exactly. So I guess that they are the most vulnerable students in the university because they don't have any experience with the university system. And they, you know, had 4 days of class. So it was...
That's crazy.
It was crazy.
What about like things like, I mean, do they have access to, you know, basic things like laptops and internet and those sorts of things? Are they kitted out?
I mean, that's one of the issues that the university is facing. So there, you know, inequality is, it's a common thing, especially in South America. So, we have students who have, you know, laptops, high speed internet, nice houses that they can, you know, take their online classes in their rooms and they're fine.
They're okay.
But then we have other students who don't have laptops, they don't have access to internet, they share their house with 10 other people, so it's really complicated for them. So the university has provided help for students who don't have access to internet, so they have bought internet for them, and they have bought laptops, and they have been trying to kind of like level the playing field a little bit, but it's really hard. In, you know, there are some things that just cannot be solved, like the fact that some students just don't have the best environment to take online classes, or they have to share their computer with other family members. So that has been a challenge, I think. And although the university has tried to make up for that, and I don't think they've done what they can, but there are some things that just can't be solved. And we also, I don't know how you guys do it there, but we also record our classes. And so they can, if they cannot for some reason connect at that particular time, they can watch the video afterwards. Then we also upload our PowerPoints. So that
and you already had. Oh, sorry, Carla. No. I was going to say, and you already had a lot of experience with all of this transitioning because of the mobilizations in the fall, right? Is that right?
Yeah. So I actually didn't teach online because these the professors who actually taught online were those who actually taught after 6 p.m.
Okay.
And so they did online classes. But there was, even if I didn't do it, there was some kind of like built-in experience. So the, you know, the chair of the department sort of knew how to make this transition smoother for all of us. So, you know, in general terms, I don't think it has been as bad as I thought it would be. So it's been easier in that sense. And I also think that in general, teaching the social sciences, it's a bit easier to teach an online class. And you know, we use Zoom. So it has a lot of kind of like tools that students can use to participate. They can raise their hands and all of that. So it hasn't been as bad. And that definitely helped to have kind of like sort of that experience in the back based on what, you know, happened last semester and with the mobilizations.
Helped. Can you talk to us about that? So this year has been just like a year of crazy disruption to Chilean life. Starting in October. So what was the cause of all of this disruption? Can you give us a bigger background?
Sure. So the mass mobilizations, so the what they call the, you know, the social estallido social, it's called, it's like, you know, this social outburst. So they it started actually on October 18th, but there were some mobilizations the weeks before that date. And it basically sort of the immediate cause was the increase in the fares of the metro fare. There's a group of experts who decides how and when they're going to increase the fares, and they increased the metro fare by 30 pesos, which is about $0.04.
Okay.
And so
4 cents.
4 cents, exactly. Yeah. And it sounds like you know, it doesn't sound like much, but the mean income or the minimum wage in Chile is very low. You know, it's about $380 dollars or so. And you know,
a month,
and inequality is really high. And so the median income is about $550 or something like that. So, you know, it adds up. And this was, as I said, this was the immediate cost. But they would say it's not the 30 pesos, it is the 30 years, speaking about, you know, the post-transition period and how this, all of sort of the promises and the expectations were not met. And so there are...
So what are we talking, like hundreds, thousands of people on the street? Like,
Yeah.
All right.
And not only that, so there were mass protests. We had a huge protest.
I mean, over a million.
Over a million.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Over a million.
So shut down.
Yeah.
Cities and stuff.
And also, it was mostly in Santiago and in other main cities, but that million, the million people march was mostly in Santiago. But it was part of it. And also there was destruction of public infrastructure, mainly the metro stations. So many metro stations were damaged, not all of them destroyed, But that basically cost, you know, a whole mess in the city. The transportation system was shut down for the entire weekend. We had a curfew. I mean, and all of these measures that we had military on the streets, which in a country like Chile, it's, you know, it feels weird. It's
a sensitive topic.
It's a very sensitive topic. So, and, you know, it was basically regarding the structural sort of causes of the mobilization, the 30 pesos was actually kind of like a symbol of all of, you know, sort of the inequality, the marginalization, and pretty much against this sort of neoliberal system, right? That people see as you know, very unjust. So it's a mobilization against injustice, basically, and it's been centered around kind of like it's very vague. So it has lots of demands. It doesn't have a particular policy, but you know, demands for better health, better education, better pensions. And I would say that sort of the overarching demand would be the new constitution. So the constitution we have is from the 1980. It had some modifications about 15 years ago, but it was created under the dictatorship. So it has some legitimacy problems.
And were these issues still sort of bubbling up and unresolved when we come to March and the pandemic gets underway, or like were you still in the middle of it?
So the mobilization stopped. We haven't had, there have been like some minor sort of kind of like points where people have mobilized in the city, but very, very, very minor. But, you know, the government actually launched what they call a new social agenda. And they promised a bunch of policies regarding education, pensions, minimum wage, health. And, you know, many of those have been sort of implemented, and they were planned from, you know, that time. This occurred in October, but they complement all of the other measures that the government has implemented due to the coronavirus pandemic. But others have been, you know, put on hold, like the plebiscite. We were supposed to have a plebiscite in April to reform the constitution. And it has been moved to October because it is pretty much impossible. And that was sort of one of the, you know, key demands of the movement to change the constitution. And that's not going to happen until October.
And Carla, weren't you saying that you were expecting also that the mobilization was going to have another big strike and a big protest again, sort of with the start of the academic year again?
Well, yeah, that's what we actually were thinking about in designing our syllabi, thinking about, you know, that the protests would resume in March. And yeah, I mean, on March 8th, there was the big feminist march. There was a national strike planned for March 9th on Monday, which was our first day of class. And that also happened. But, you know, we didn't really have much. There were some protests and there was some mobilization and some confrontations between the police and some marchers, because that was another big issue of this mobilization. But, you know, we didn't get to see any of that because of coronavirus. I mean, everything was sort of put on hold. And, you know, the thing is that we don't know that if once, you know, that the risk of infection goes down, if mobilizations are going to begin again. There's this kind of like feeling that everything's going to be normal in October for some reason that I don't know, right? So it's, and so...
It's not.
Exactly, right? But people, I don't know, it's a coping device, I think. It's a coping strategy to think that things are going to be normal.
I'm interested though, like, so these, like you describe all of these sort of simmering tensions within the polities. Is this colouring the way in which people are perceiving the government's policies and its strategy for dealing with the virus? Or?
So I think, you know, the approval rates of the government went down to historical low levels, like 10% of approval
in
the aftermath. Okay. So in the aftermath of the mobilizations, and you know, disapproval rates of 82%.
I mean, I feel like that's historic in an international context.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was really hard to register that degree of.
Yeah, it was super low.
Even your mom doesn't like you at
that point. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, who likes you? Exactly. So it was pretty low. But now after, you know, coronavirus, it's actually been good for the government's approval rates. They've, according to recent polls, they're about 22%. And disapproval rates are about 67 or something like that. So,
So can you give us a picture of sort of what the government is doing? So you said March 16th, your university moved online, but is this already once the government says, okay, now you have a curfew again, don't you?
We do have a curfew. We had mandatory quarantine. I was actually locked inside my house until April 13th. So
like one full month?
Almost, yeah. The mandatory quarantine wasn't implemented until late March. So I was probably 3 weeks inside my house. Okay. I mean, I'm still inside my house. I don't leave unless I really have to. But yeah, so lots of measures like that, mandatory quarantine, the curfew, it starts at 10 p.m. And I think it lasts until 7 a.m. in the morning. And you know, that was kind of like the main measures to sort of prevent that people leave. They left their houses, but there, you know, the economy was also pretty hard hit after the mobilization. So, lots of people lost their jobs, and you know, restaurants. It's the same, I guess, everywhere. But restaurants were closed, and so the government has launched a series of economic policies, like to you know, subsidies for families, sort of like. Loans for companies and series of policies like that. And also, you know, just trying to get the economy back on track. But I think it is going to be pretty, pretty, pretty hard. Some laws, you know, they passed this labor protection law to kind of like help workers keep their jobs, and you know, it's pretty specific, but they were intended to sort of prevent massive layoff of the people were fired from their jobs. So but yeah, they actually have this bono COVID, like a COVID subsidy that they give to families.
Carla, I'm interested because I'm interested in tracking the different ways in which lockdowns occur in different countries. And so you mentioned curfew, which has been a specific sort of strategy that's been adopted in particular states. I'm wondering why that is. Like, is it because historically, the like under, you know, the authoritarian regime in the 70s, is that something that was commonly utilized, like an instrument that people are familiar with? Does it have historical resonances in Chile? Or is it, I don't know, just like a random choice that they pick up on?
Well, that for sure. During the dictatorship, the curfew was kind of like the rule, you know, the everyone was inside their homes at night. But we hadn't had curfews during the Democratic period. And we did have them last year after the mobilizations. So we had curfew, a curfew implemented, served the same after 10 p.m. But that lasted only a couple of days. It was it felt really weird to have that. It's different. I think the feeling is just different right now because it is not political. It is to sort of face this pandemic. So I think now it feels a bit different.
Carla.
Sure.
Sorry, can I ask you?
Of course.
Was it when during the curfews of the last under the mobilization that the Cacerolazo started? Santiago?
Yeah. The Cacerolazo started early on.
Please translate it's, somebody.
pot banging. I don't know how to.
Pot banging. Oh, the banging. People were banging their pots from their homes. And it's very, it's actually like really unexpectedly moving. But, and it has a lot, much longer tradition. So it didn't just emerge in that moment. But it is like something that, a tool women could use to protest historically. And then, that's at least around the myth around it. And then in Santiago, they started to do it in the curfew. And then you see it spread to a lot of places. So a lot of cities in Latin America also had demonstrations. Yeah. And I think in Santiago, they were the largest by far and like the most geared towards really deep reforms, I would say. But also in Bogota, you saw these cacerolazos and people singing hymns together or songs.
Right.
Because they also had curfews then as a result of their mobilizations. I mean, it was really, I think, it was a remarkable. So I just wanted to wanted to ask about the Cacerolazo.
If it
started then.
They started, I think, a bit earlier than that because I think so. And they didn't start at the beginning. They weren't at night. So, when you walked around, people were actually banging their pots on the street.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
With kids, it was, very, but then they were doing it from their balconies. When we were under curfew. Yeah. So now again, I don't know, until when we're going to have, the curfew, but I think, it was partly because people were not respecting the mandatory the quarantine, like stay at home, don't do parties, don't meet with others. That's one of the measures. Also, there are other measures that people should not go to their their holiday homes, their vacation houses. In order to
do
that,
are people listening to that?
Some.
I was going to say in Bogota they were doing the mayor there decided to do a trial run on a quarantine for the city. Did you see this?
No.
And she explained, okay, we're going to do a trial run. It's going to be from Friday to Monday at midnight, I think. And she said, for those of you who have houses outside the city, this is not a vacation weekend. And she said, if you leave, you are not coming back. Like, we will block the roads. So she was really angry. But I like the idea that she did a kind of practice run of what a quarantine would look like. And then the president of Colombia decided to implement a nationwide quarantine that would start the day after the practice. So that was, like, a little bit... disrupted the purpose of having a trial run and then made everyone nervous again. But anyway, the point was there were a lot of wealthy people who were trying to leave the city to go to their fincas.
Yeah, we had some cases of people who went to their vacation houses in helicopters. I don't know if they thought that
that's a really nice illustration of the inequality in Chile.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, you have how many people who are living in really precarious circumstances. And can you talk a little bit about the migrant workers?
Yeah, so they were this happened a couple of days ago. There were about 400 Bolivian temporary workers. They come here to work a couple months a year or weeks a year. I'm not sure. But Bolivia closed their borders, and they were mandating people to fulfill sort of a quarantine before entering the country. But these people had ran out of money to, you know, support themselves here while they were doing this quarantine. And so, you know, they were basically living on the street. And not only that, they were just camping in the streets during the curfew, which is, you know, exactly. And there were, you know, kids, pregnant women. It was really terrible. Right outside, there were the Bolivian consulate, because Chile and Bolivia don't have diplomatic relations. So we
Can I just open a parenthesis to say, sure, a shocking tidbit that I didn't know at all. And yeah, so Chile and Bolivia have been, you know, they are neighbors, for those of you who are unfamiliar with South American geography. And they don't have diplomatic relations. And not only that, this has been like, they may not have ever had diplomatic relations. Really? Like, they had a war in the 19th century. Carla and I were talking about this, and it's just not clear that there were ever diplomatic relations developed.
So what my understanding is that since 1978, we don't have diplomatic relations, like formally. Okay, but relations have been pretty bad, you know, ever since the war. And
that's pretty bad.
It is pretty bad. So yeah, it was, you know, and I think it's interesting what you said about the mayor of Bogota, because I think one of the main political actors that has, you know, emerged from this pandemic is mayors. The mayors have become super important. And actually, one of the mayors in one of the localities here in Santiago, she was, you know, pushing the Bolivian president to open the borders, or at least let them in. And, you know, if the president committed to let them in if they fulfilled this quarantine, then she would give them shelter, sort of a formal shelter, not let them be on the streets. And now they sort of, you know, they figure it out, and now they were transported to the north of the country, which borders Bolivia, for them to be in a shelter and do their quarantine and then hopefully enter the country.
Right.
But yeah, it was pretty crazy. And it's interesting to see how, you know, local it's a weird dynamic, despite the fact that this is very global, you know, it has affected every country in the world. Local leaders have sort of stepped up as very important actors in this whole crisis. Here in Chile, at least, the mayors have been super, so they just, you know, in things that should be decided nationally, like they pushed the government to close the schools, for instance, and they've, you know, they've become super relevant political actors, and they are probably the political actors who have better, you know, popular evaluation according to polls. So I think this is all.
I think really fascinating.
Lots of people are saying, thank goodness for federalism and local government, right? Like in the Netherlands, we have Groningen, which goes its own way on testing. And in the US, there's different states taking different approaches.
In US, the governor, have you two seen that the governor of Maryland, you know, brokered a deal to get tests from South Korea for his state? And has the National Guard, which is sort of, I would say, you know, a fancy word for the state militia, basically, guarding these tests in a secret location so that the federal government doesn't seize the tests, because that has happened to other states. Yeah, so it's full on crazy. But I think these... Because it is exactly what you say, Carla. It's like it's kind of paradoxical, because it's such a global problem, and then you see all of this like local level innovation and like international relationships sort of initiated by local actors, like the mayor you just talked about with the president of Bolivia, the governor of Maryland with the South Korean government, you know. I think all of that is super fascinating too.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So before we get done, I need to talk about, so in my, you know, preparation for this podcast, I'm knowing nothing about Chile. I went online and tried to find out what's going on. And the first thing that came up was immunity cards, which is like a favorite topic of mine, that in some way in Chile, you're thinking of trialing this out, or, and this is the idea, of course, that like once someone has had the virus and they have tested for the antibodies, they can presumably have a card which says they are immune, so-called, and go back to work. What's going on in Chile in that regard?
So yeah, that started the talk about this immunity cards, you know, started out about 3 weeks ago, and they were saying the word immunity. They were talking about immunity and you know, saying that person who had the cards was sort of immune. And that the way they were describing these cards has changed a lot in this past 3 weeks. They're not talking anymore about immunity. I think it was partly because, you know, WHO stepped in and said that this wasn't really a good idea. We know very little about immunity with regards to COVID. And so they're not talking about immunity anymore. So what they're talking about is giving people a card that says, sort of states that person had COVID, you know, finished her treatment or whatever the quarantine period and recovered. But that's pretty much, the last information I have is that's pretty much what those cards are going to do. They're going to tell you that person had COVID and that person finished her treatment.
Finished the quarantine.
Or in the quarantine, yeah. Whatever it is.
So you're talking about the serological test then, the test for the virus rather than the antibodies. Is that what they're going to use or thinking of using?
I think it's going to vary depending. Well, they were talking about the G test, right? I don't remember the yeah, exactly. No, it's the immune something. It's not the regular that everyone's using, right? Yeah. Okay. Yep, PCR, yep. RCP, I don't remember the name. Yeah, but they're talking about using that test, but I'm not sure. I'm not really sure what they're actually going to use.
And what would be the function of the card? Like, have they spoken about it?
I assume
why they would institute it, what would be useful?
I think it's useful because they think it is useful because when you have COVID, you have to be on, you know, in home quarantine. So you have to be inside your house. Mm-hmm. So I think if you leave your house and you know, the police or whatever does an identity control, you can show that you just fulfilled all of the requirements to be on the streets again. I think that's the purpose of the card at this point. So to sort of, to authorize that person to be on the streets again.
And is there an impression, Carla, that the police or is the military still mobilized from the mobilizations also, or is it now just the police who are doing the enforcement of the curfew and everything?
The police, but if I'm not mistaken, the military have some role too, because we are actually on a state of catastrophe. That's why you can implement a curfew.
Oh, okay.
It's a constitutional state of emergency or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. So this is really a lot stricter than our last week's episode when we talked about Japan, where their state of emergency is basically like, we're going to ask you nicely to abide by the law. And your state of emergency is now you have to stay indoors, you know, and we will have, you know, the police monitoring.
To be fair, It wasn't asked nicely. It was strongly requested.
Strongly requested.
Strongly requested. But they weren't sure whether they were going to use strongly yet, because that seemed too strong. They were just going with request for the moment.
It might be. That's true. But, you know, here also, I would say we've heard stories of, you know, people arriving from the U.S. to the airport and people, you know, officials there just sort of saying, yeah, please stay in your homes. Right. Where in Latin America, the reaction has been way stricter. And I think with good reason, because, you know, the stakes are higher for healthcare systems that could be more potentially easily overwhelmed. And you had, you know, I don't know for the first time in how long, but you had Colombia deporting a French couple that violated this request, you know, this strong request. It's actually enforced mandate, actually. And I think a Spanish couple, I think a Spanish and French couple were each deported from Colombia for violating this rule early on in the process. But in the Netherlands, yeah, it's just kind of like, yeah, please quarantine yourself. And in my case that we started talking about in the beginning of the hour, it was like a little hand wave, like, yeah, maybe you have COVID. And when I ask for a follow-up, you know, should I quarantine? It's like, well, you know, just be reasonable. Like, I'm just like, what's going on? Yeah, I guess if we do a comparison, Chile and the Netherlands have the same population, right? About roughly 17 million.
Yeah.
And Chile has many, you know, an order of magnitude fewer deaths. You know, part of that is the luck of when, you know, where we were, how the infection spread. But I think another layer of that is just the seriousness of the measures, right?
Yeah.
And Carla, do you have any sense, is the government giving the Chileans like any sense of sort of, here you hear a lot of pressure of sort of, when are we going to start to ease restrictions? Is there talk about that in Chile? And how is the government communicating its plans to everyone?
So, yeah, I mean, the measures have, again, are very local, so they vary a lot by area. And, you know, I live in Santiago, and it's different depending on the region of the country. So not the entire country is under the curfew at 10 p.m., but not so mandatory curfews and all the other measures have not been implemented equally across the territory, not even in Santiago. So now I'm not in mandatory curfew, but there are other localities that are. It's really that, and they're doing something that is really, people have a hard time understanding. I have a hard time understanding. So they're doing sort of mandatory curfews, dividing. So Santiago is sort of divided like Bogota. We have comunas, which is the entire city is divided in, you can say localities. I don't know how to do their.
I don't either. Called.
Yeah.
Neighborhoods, but they're bigger than neighborhoods.
They're way bigger. Yeah. Yeah. So, and each of these localities
has maybe for the American audience, boroughs.
Yeah. And each of them has their own mayor. So,
Okay.
Yeah. And it is different. And Santiago is a whole city. We don't have a mayor of Santiago, the whole city.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So it's varied a lot, and some of these localities have actually, you know, they have quarantine from this street to that street, so not even so that's really okay. it's kind of hard to understand. So I live on this side of this avenue and I'm not in quarantine, and on the other side of the avenue they are in quarantine. So the virus
can't cross the street.
The street, apparently. So yeah, that's kind of like weird. But as I said, it's very local, so it varies a lot. And in some areas, these measures have been implemented very recently. And here, for instance, where I live, we had mandatory quarantine, but I I don't have that anymore, so I can leave my house and that's okay. Some other cities, they have implemented very local norms to wear masks all the time if you're on the streets. Others don't have that, so you know, it varies a lot.
Okay.
So I think they're just, you know, analyzing data.
And is the
data.
President giving a sort of overall message?
Anything? So they have every morning the health minister and his team, they, you know, tell the country how many new cases we have, how many people have died, the total count of people who have COVID, how many have recovered. So we know all of those statistics, and the president also talks regularly. So
okay.
But again, I mean, that's sort of like the national level sort of information, and then it varies. They in those kind of like those reports the government gives, they tell the people sort of if there has been any change regarding the quarantines. But then there are all of these other sort of more local measures that mayors basically have implemented.
Okay.
So yeah. So we have sort of national measures and also very local initiatives.
Well, that's fascinating. And it'll be fascinating to see, you know, if some localities fare better than others, or if you all kind of converge on one.
I just find it really difficult because I think with these really tough measures, what you want to see or what you want to know is that everyone's doing the same thing at the same time. This is what we've all got to do. So I would find that, I mean, I relate to the Netherlands. If in the Netherlands you saw someone in the other part of the city doing something different, you'd be like, stuff this, I'm not doing that anymore.
Yeah.
It would be a very slow burn.
No, and it's really weird. And also because I think, and I'm one of those, I really don't know when one of those localities ends and when they start.
Yeah.
Like, boundaries of them, I don't have them. I really don't know.
You could be violating borders all the time, which is ironic because you study borders.
Exactly. But national borders, subnational borders are, exactly. So I guess some people really don't know when one of this ends and the other begins. So you have to have the geography, the administrative division of your city very clear when you're going to implement, you know, different measures by locality. So,
Monday morning meetings on migration is brought to you by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. You can find us on our WordPress site or alternatively on Facebook or Twitter. If you have ideas about a show that we ought to feature or a guest that we ought to have on, please contact Abby or I on imes@uva.nl.